Welcome to Solid Science, a podcast that is about soil.
Well, it's not about soil, but about its ecology and what we can learn from it. And it's about science.
Well, it's not about science, but how knowledge is produced. But it is about people.
It's not about people, but about their experiences.
Hi, I'm Romy, a young researcher that cares about the health of the environment.
And I'm Carlos, two soil microecologists working in conservation ecology.
Today we will talk about plastics and multiple soil pressures, and we invited Matthias Riddick to talk with us about it. Welcome, Matthias. So can you quickly introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Matthias Riddick. I'm a professor of ecology at Freie Universität Berlin. And my hobbies are to work on soil and to ask questions about what novel factors might affect soil. And, some of those factors are microplastic, but also the contribution of many factors, how they affect soil. The organisms that live in soil, soil properties, soil processes, and with that, overall ecosystem processes.
So, Matthias, you said that it's your hobby to study soils, which is cool, a cool way of approaching this. But I was wondering what has fascinated you to come to the world of plastics also, because, you know, plastic is like a media also in soil, can also act as a media in soil. It's also a pollutant in some way. So what fascinated you to come to that?
I thought you were going to ask me what fascinated me about soil, but maybe that's a different story.
It can also be that. Sure. It can also be that.
That's definitely not a love at first sight, eh? I mean, that was sort of, you don't get born thinking that soil is the coolest topic ever. That came sort of much later. It was more like a rationalized choice, like where's the most unknown, basically, in ecology. So that's what led to soil. And in hindsight, of course, it was an excellent choice because this is still where many things can be discovered. Now, but microplastic, I think that is sort of an interesting case where you take one question or one topic from a domain or realm of ecology where it has already been studied, and you transfer it to another realm where it had never been studied. I'm very interested in making these kinds of connections actually in various different ways. And in this case, it was just basically ecosystem type, because microplastic had been studied and plastic had been studied for a long time in the oceans. Actually, the first paper was like even on the cover of Science in 1974. So many decades ago. And how we got to know about microplastic is like we generally every year, as like the first paper we read is this horizon scanning paper by Bill Sutherland. And it was one of these, I think maybe in 2010, where they mentioned about microplastic. And then as normal in our lab meetings, we always asked like, and what about soil? And so we had never heard of microplastics, so we just started Googling around. And then it turns out that no results, no paper, nothing written on microplastic. And I wrote the first paper on it. It was published in 2012. It was very carefully ignored by everybody for 3 to 4 years. It was not cited at all. It's now been cited quite a few times, and now microplastic is like a major research topic for in terrestrial ecosystems. So it's funny how it goes. And you know, in the beginning, we did a lot of like little experiments with microplastic with bachelor thesis and things like that. Mostly they didn't yield a lot of compelling results, as it always is when you start something, you don't know what's important. You know, with microplastic especially, it's such a diverse suite of pollutants and particles. That it is very important with which type you work that will determine a lot the results. And so, and I think in the beginning, we just stumbled around in the dark, as is normal when you do something like that. And then, you know, eventually we stumbled across, when you use fibers rather than the powders that you can buy from the catalog, when you use fibers, which we had to painstakingly cut with scissors, it was like, totally terrible. Then we saw suddenly quite drastic effects in soil. And so that, of course, started that entire enterprise. And what fascinates me about it to this day is that it is basically the only, or maybe, well, one of the few cases where a pollutant is actually a particle, not just a chemical. And that has a lot of sort of conceptual consequences. For example, the shape matters, as I just explained. You know, the fibers had completely different effects from the powders and fragments, and the films have different effects from the foams, etc. So, I mean, it is very much a case where the shape of a pollutant matters. That is very unusual. And also there is things about these things having an internal volume. These are really particles with an internal volume, and things diffuse in the interior of these particles to the outside, where they know then things are released that are probably mostly responsible for toxic effects, like the additives that are in plastic. We found that they are often responsible for the very strong negative toxic effects that some of these particles can have. And, you know, they diffuse in the inside of these particles, and then are released over time. It's like a you know, slow release toxin. it's just very, very interesting in a number of ways what these things do, especially to soil properties.
So I would like to come back later on to this connecting disciplines that you mentioned, but you right just now you already mentioned several different types of elements that you could study in plastics: the shape, the volume, the type of chemical, and so on. Can you tell us specifically to soils, what type of plastics would you either use in your research or that we would find in soils, and what are the main sources? Because a while ago, I was reading a paper about the plastics that come out of the tires when you are in the highway, for example. This is a source of plastic that maybe it's not that obvious. So what are these types of plastics that you find, and what are their main sources?
Yeah, I mean, that is an interesting and great question. And, you know, it depends very much where you stand.
Okay.
Carlos. So if you are standing on an agricultural soil, then you will experience completely different entrance pathways than if you stand somewhere in an alpine grassland, let's say. You know, if you're in an agricultural soil, chances are there is plastic mulching material used. That is a huge source of plastic pollution in many parts of the world, especially in China, where they have vast areas of land under plastic cover, but also in Southern Europe. And then you have the addition of plastic into agricultural soils via organic fertilizers, especially compost and, you know, also manure additions. Composts are also full of plastic particles because the plastic residues cannot really be effectively collected before that stuff gets shredded. So basically you produce microplastic in the process and gets added to agricultural fields or your potted plants. And so, I mean, all of that stuff has plastic in it. So that is the major input pathway. There's many other things. You know, there's the tubing, there is the netting, there is everything you use in an agricultural context is plastic. We just had a paper on that that just details all the various sources. It's plastic addicted. Basically, agriculture functions at this industrial scale currently because of the very many uses of plastic. And of course, that's currently necessary and is difficult to replace, but we need to probably think about replacing it. If you're standing near a road, then of course, tire wear particles become the dominant source. This is a bit of a different case. It's not just plastic. There's also other components in there like carbon black and rubber and other things. And it's also usually full of zinc. And so that has often direct toxic effects, at least when we did studies. That is also a very dominant source of microplastic. If you stand somewhere very far away from any human impact per se, then you will mostly experience fibers. Because fibers are so light and they have very good buoyancy in air because they are so light, and maybe also because of their shape, that they get easily entrained in wind and in the atmosphere. And they can just then rain down. So the stuff that mostly just rains down on us, wherever you are, basically, that's fibers. So this is what we also commonly find is fibers in soils. And actually, one of the first papers on plastic in soils, which is sort of a more an incidental paper, they looked actually at fibers that they found in on an agricultural field where the last sort of organic fertilizer addition or anthropogenic addition was like many, many decades ago. I guess I can't remember the exact details now, but the stuff that was still in there that they could detect, if not readily quantify, but at least detect that was there, phenomenologically described, were fibers. So I think that they are going to be everywhere. So the answer depends very much on where you are. Yeah.
You now mentioned two different things about the plastics. So on the one hand, there is this observation, right? You stand in the field and you look what is occurring here. And then you mentioned that you are cutting down plastic. So how do you actually investigate or measure the impact of microplastics on soil?
Yeah, well, that's actually relatively easy compared to many other global change factors where you have to build expensive exposure systems. You know, think about warming or elevated CO2. It's just take the stuff and add it to soil. That's it. So this is also why it's so easy to do and why many people do it now. I mean, there's more to it, right? You know, I mean, you have to sort of mix it in, and fibers are notoriously terrible to mix in because they tend to entangle with each other and sort of make these little nests of fibers that is very difficult to dissolve and then even to distribute if that's your goal. But other than that, you just add the material that you have either shredded or wherever you get it by from a catalog, or cut it into smaller pieces, for example, for films, and then you add it to the soil. Of course, you can also pre-treat it, because we know that most of the plastic out there in the environment that has effects is not virgin plastic that you have, you know, everywhere around your office, for example, but it's been weathered, you know, by UV light and other things. And so we have sort of also built from a postdoc in my lab, Walter Waldman, he built a UV weathering chamber where we basically just expose the various plastic types to strong UV light and have sort of accelerated weathering, so simulating the exposure to the environment. And that then probably is slightly more realistic. And we have also just the recent paper that shows that the weathered plastic has kind of different effects than the virgin plastic, you know, because it gets oxidized on the surface. You have different surface properties. Probably stuff leaches out more readily. Stuff gets more brittle. Stuff gets discolored. And you know, I guess it's easy, relatively easy to understand why they have different effects. I mean, you cannot predict the effect direction. In our case, often it made things worse. I would not have necessarily predicted that. But it definitely changes the effect. So there is, you know, a bit more detail at that front end. But basically, once you have the particles, whatever particle you would like to use, or combination of particles, then you just add it, mix it into soil, and off you go.
And you always need a reference value, I guess, for the experiment. So you try to have the similar amount of plastic. How do you measure the actual amount of plastic that is out there?
Yeah, this is not our specialty. We are not the analytical people. We also do a little bit of that. And of course, it depends a lot on where you measure it. If you measure some hot spots like agricultural fields, you will likely get values that are, you know, a bit higher. So what concentration we use in experiments is actually an interesting point. And actually, one of the more interesting things I learned in general about microplastic research, and that namely, there are two vantage points from which you can view microplastic research. One is the vantage point of ecotoxicology, which is the dominant one and the one under which we first started working. The other one is the vantage point of global change biology. That seems like a trivial difference, but actually it is a very, very interesting difference in perspective. And I just illustrate this with the case of the concentration, since you mentioned, and this is also one of the most frequent reviewer comments. It's like, if you are operating under an ecotoxicology framework, then you want to know and need to know the current concentration that is out there, the environment, for your estimation of risk. And so therefore, you have to use probably quite low concentrations, which most places, at least in Europe or in Germany, this is quite different in other places, I'm sure, experience relatively low concentrations. This is the concentration you would then use in your experiment in under an ecotoxicology framework. The ecotoxicology framework is one way to do it, and it's a correct way of doing it, but it's not the only way of doing it. And in particular, it doesn't deal very well with positive effects. We very often had positive effects. This is so confusing to us when we started with microplastic research. None of this stuff is published, but when we did these first experiments, we often observed positive effects. I mean, nominally positive increases in the response variable. That was very, very confusing to us because we operated under this framework of ecotoxicology and you have an expected negative effect. If you don't, our conclusion was we did something wrong. And so these data were all basically tossed until it took a couple of years to realize that what we have here is a pollutant, of course, and thus it is appropriately dealt with in the discipline of ecotoxicology, but it is also a global change factor because it has global scope in occurrence. It's linked to human activity, quite obviously, and it affects biota, which we and others have subsequently shown. So it meets the criteria of a global change factor. Now, if you are operating under the framework of global change, things change. For example, a nominally positive effect is completely fine because many global change factors have nominally positive effects like elevated CO2 on plants. It's like a fertilizer, nitrogen deposition on plants. It is a fertilizer. It's a resource. Warming because of Q10 effects, whatever. Many global change factors have nominally positive effects on their target organism. Positive doesn't mean desirable. It just means that something increases. And the second point is, if you are interested in global change, then you are not interested in using current concentrations, but you're interested in using potential future concentrations. Like if you are doing an elevated CO2 experiment, it would be utterly pointless to use the current CO2 concentration as your treatment, right? You want to know what happens in 50 to 100 years. Now, we don't know what happens in the 50 and 100 years with microplastic, so we don't have a very good guess. But we use a high concentration because we know that stuff accumulates in soil. It gets produced ever increasing at ever increasing rates, and it gets into the environment. So from a global change perspective, you basically have license to explore also higher concentrations. There's many other changes that go along with this vantage point. I find it super interesting because it seems such a trivial difference. It seems almost like, you know, it seems like an academic point, basically, if this is an ecotoxicology or a global change problem. But in reality, it really changes everything. And it definitely changed everything for us. And so I think that my very complicated and long-winded response to your question about concentrations is we use a fairly high concentration in our experiments because we want to know where this could potentially go.
That makes sense. I mean, there's also, so you mentioned these global change factor now. So what is it, or in what way does do microplastics influence the soil? Because you mentioned also positive effects. So what's the pathway there?
Yeah, so what's really interesting to us is that it changed soil structure. This is, in fact, really the first thing that we did measure. So it's we are interested in soil aggregation and soil structure, generally speaking, have always been for a long time. And so, of course, this was one of our first response variables to look at. And that is really where it all started for us. We found really profound effects on soil structure at various levels, just physical effects. When you add fibers to soil, the soil gets basically fluffier, so there is lower bulk density. And I think because of that, roots have an easier time growing in that soil, and you get increased plant growth, increased root growth, increased shoot biomass, increased mycorrhizal colonization. We found that repeatedly. So there's very many positive effects. Of course, these positive effects are not, as I mentioned, necessarily desirable. That is a different question, because we also measured effects on plant communities. And on plant communities, the effects are still positive in terms of biomass, but of course you get shifts in plant community composition. And that is a deviation from the natural course, the natural course of things. And you can interpret that as a damage or a deviation from the natural state. And that can be interpreted as negative. It's the same for elevated CO2 and warming and all these factors as well. So we find positive effects often on plant growth, but not always. We also find negative effects on plant growth. Actually, we have one experiment that we are writing up right now where we have quite negative effects on plant growth of wheat plants in an agricultural context. And actually, we use different agricultural soils, three different agricultural soils, and in every soil, the same plastic, the same plant has a different effect. It's quite stunning. The effects are not subtle. The effects are quite pronounced, and they are the opposite direction in different soils. Like, it's actually one positive, one neutral, one negative. I mean, you couldn't ask for more, but just having chosen three agriculturally important soils in Germany. So, I mean, that is quite stunning. So I think that, you know, the first answer to that question is, like, it depends on the soil. It depends on the microplastic type, as already mentioned. And other effects include changes in microbial community composition. Like, for example, the plastosphere microbial community, the community that is near these plastic particles or on these plastic particles, is drastically changed from the bulk soil microbiome. It's enriched in antibiotic resistance genes, for example, which we've shown in collaboration with people from China, and is also enriched in potential pathogens. Not a good combination, potentially. And we have effects on soil aggregate water stability that are often the opposite of the effects that are on the overall physical status of the soil. They often decrease water stable aggregation, especially fibers, because, you know, we have some pictures where they like stick out of the aggregates and probably are transporting water into the center of the aggregates, or they act as little levers to pry the aggregate open. We don't know exactly the mechanism. There is changes in greenhouse gas emissions, probably as a consequence of changes in soil aggregation. Yeah, basically, if you have changes in soil structure, you're going to have a lot of other things affected. And, you know, then we have toxic effects at the micro scale. For example, with nematodes, we found that a whole range of different household microplastics were toxic to nematode reproduction. And those same things were actually positive on plant growth, which I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. Of course, nematodes are totally different from plants, so that's the obvious answer. But I think there is something more to it. I think that there may be these more soil level overall physical effects just due to the fact that you added a particle. And then there may be quite different and also opposite microscale negative effects, which are due to the additives leaching out of these particles. We showed that it's the additives, not the particles themselves. And, you know, at the overall plant scale, you probably have like the net effect. That is what you see, which is in our case often still positive, but may also be negative if these more small scale toxic effects outweigh the general physical effects. I don't know that for sure. This is just what I'm currently making up in my head, right? So I think it makes a lot of sense, but I have no real evidence for that now.
But yes, you were mentioning, for example, the experiment that you had with these three different soil types and that the effects were different. And in the back of my mind, I was just circling back to something that you said in the beginning of all of this, that a plastic is not only a pollutant, it's also a particle. So you are, by adding plastics to the soil, as you said, you are changing the soil structure, but you are also, I'm guessing, that's my question to you, changing many of the properties that both plants and organisms rely on, like repellency of water repellency, or even the permeability of the soils because of all of these things. And for example, you mentioned nematodes. I'm guessing that there's a toxin pathway, but there's potentially also availability of water pathway that also reduces their reproducibility. What do you think about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's changes in porosity that mirror basically the changes in physical soil structure, or that you could say this is a component of physical soil structure, is the solids and the pore spaces. They're both important, of course. We also know there's differences on water holding capacity. There's differences in water behavior. Everything you said is correct. Just one small addition to what you said, the presence of the particle is also an aspect of the pollution. It's not just the additives leaching out. So this sort of moves it more in the realm of just normal standard toxicity, which is based on chemicals like, you know, PFAS or whatever, individual organic chemicals. It is important to consider the particle also the pollutant. It's a physical pollutant. It's very interesting. I mean, microplastics I did a classification of global change factors a few years ago where I thought deep thoughts about microplastic. And, you know, basically I realized that, you know, microplastics are this chemical pollutant because, you know, I mean, of course, they're also chemical things. They are polymers and things. But, you know, what is the most effective part of that is the additives leaching out of them, I think, in most cases. But since this is a particle, it really sets it apart from all the other things that are pollutants. And, you know, I call that is a form of physical pollutant. There's other physical pollutants, like, you know, there's noise pollution, and there's sound pollution, there's light pollution, which is also energy, there's warming, which is also basically, you can think of it as energy pollution. And so there's other physical pollutants, but this is a physical pollutant that is a particle. Yeah.
That's very interesting. And so let's go a bit further now. If we compare it to marine systems, when I think of microplastics there, I think many people know now that they can accumulate in fish and then it can be toxic for us. And in soils, I guess, or I hope, that is also happening now, that people see, okay, if it's in the agricultural field, it might end up in the plant and then we also consume it. So what is your feeling about this, all of these impacts of microplastics on soil? Are they already got into the focus of media, and is there an awareness rising ongoing?
I think that the awareness has, of course, started with the ocean. This was also shown in like posters all over Berlin from WWF and everything. I mean, this is where the focus is. And, you know, BBC Earth showing like that straw in the nose of this turtle, the marine turtle, you know, David Attenborough. And so this is, of course, in people's mind. I do think, though, that given the media attention we've had in recent years, there has been quite a lot of interest in that effect in the soil. I mean, you know, nobody ever cared about what we do here, to be honest. You know, which is fine. We had a good time. But, you know, with microplastic, basically, that really changed. I mean, people were, like, quite interested. The media, I mean, TV, radio, newspaper, magazines, podcasts, everything. So, I mean, that there was quite a lot of interest. And it seems like, as a consequence of that, there must have been some change in the awareness of this problem in soil. Yeah. And I think it is because it is so directly related to us. I mean, the fibers are from the clothes we now all wear at this very moment. I mean, it's very directly related to our daily lives. Or the, you know, the toothpaste you brush your teeth with in the morning has these agents in it that are plastics. Or like your shampoo and whatever. And so some products are now microplastic free and all that. It also happened as a consequence. And also, you know, a couple of weeks after the David Attenborough movie of the turtle with the straw in its nose, the local ice cafe in my street no longer offered plastic straws. They changed to something else. So, but I think that sort of immediate connection to what people do has increased that awareness. That is quite different from warming, you know, which is equally real, but it is so more distant in terms of us as actors, I think. I'm not sure if that's right, but I think, yeah, this is maybe part of the reason.
So a while ago, actually, I was reading this newspaper in Germany, and the topic of the article was the graffiti on the Berlin Wall that was falling, and that they were realizing that the amount of microplastics in the soil was just rising a lot because of the graffiti. So it's just paint. So if you see it from a, let's say, a common citizen perspective, it's just paint, but in reality, it holds a lot of microplastics to be able to shine in the walls and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, this was also news to me. This was our study by Yachi Chu in the lab and Walter Waldmann. They had the idea to use a different extraction protocol, which captures the much heavier pigment microplastic, which had thus far been missed. And so we sampled, actually, for context, like 7 meters away from the wall. So we didn't really get like the flaking of huge pieces of paint, most likely. We got probably the aerosols, just the aerosols. And, you know, I mean, that plastic looked like an artist's palette. Sorry, that soil looked like an artist's palette with all the microplastic pieces that were colorful in there. And what I hadn't realized is that, you know, paint, the binder in paint is plastic.
You mentioned that you try to be, let's say, strategic in your career, also trying to bring together different sciences, different things, and trying to look for the negative space in this research realm. And you also mentioned that a while ago you started looking at this problem, not as a single factor. You call it factors, or could also call it different ways, the pressures, things like this, but you started looking at it not from a single factor perspective, but actually from a multiple factor perspective. Yeah. So what I was wondering is, how do you approach this, let's say, new question that is not technically, I would say, simple, because it's not one thing, it's not a plastic that you can add to an experiment. So how do you approach this to consider multiple factors in this?
Yeah, the idea actually in the end was born after reading a paper by Emily Bernhardt et al. In 2017, where they made the point that organic chemical pollutants should be considered a factor of global change, where they haven't been, because that's been firmly in the realm of ecotoxicologists. No, ecologists didn't study that. And so that, when I read that paper, and more the idea was born that, you know, we should look at multiple things at the same time, not only just one, because this is never what happens. And so...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so then, of course, the mind was sort of working on how could you do that, and then basically... I think may have been because I gave my introductory ecology lecture on, you know, that mentioned maybe the Tillman experiment. I don't exactly know what it was anymore, where there was a solution to that problem found in a completely different area of ecology, namely biodiversity ecosystem function, where people had found a solution to like the number of items, plant richness in this case, which was sampling at random from a pool of items. In their case, it was plant species. So this was another one of these transfers. In the beginning, we talked about transfer the microplastic question from the aquatic realm to the terrestrial ecosystem. This was a transfer in terms of ecosystem type. And this was a transfer in terms of experimental design, from one area of ecology to another. So rather than using plant species, we used global change factors in our pool, and we just drew them at random. Yeah, which was actually sort of a very, very crazy idea. And I remember very vividly the lab meeting in which I introduced this idea. It's like, come on, guys, this is a great idea. Who wants to do it? And, you know, in my mind's eye, I had, of course, expected like all hands going up and people like, you know, falling over themselves. And in fact, everybody just checked their cell phones and, you know, avoided eye contact and tied their shoes, and nobody wanted to do it because it seemed like rather crazy. And I ended up doing this experiment myself, that of course people felt sorry for me seeing me sitting in the lab by myself looking rather dejected. And then, so the rest his history actually turned out to be quite interesting. Actually, the fact that the results were so interesting, I mean, what came out was basically a straight line with increasing number of factors, the all ecosystem processes, properties, and biodiversity decreased in a straight line. That was not expected at all. In fact, I expected like complete random results in the end. That would have also been fine.
Yeah,
but
sure.
You know, but the fact that it came out like as a straight line trajectory with a decreasing functionality and biodiversity, that was like a shocker. I mean, we certainly didn't see that one coming at all. And yeah, well, the rest of this, we've been playing around with this idea ever since, basically.
I would be interested in what kind of factors you actually analyze in this mixing global change factor study. So we know about land use change and pollution, which are pretty well investigated. So what factors did you investigate?
Yeah, so we cannot do land use change because land use change enters into the ecological hierarchy at a level much higher than what we work in with an individual soil sample or an individual plant soil system. So we use maybe components of land use change, for example, as well, like soil compaction or something like that. So it needs to be broken down to the appropriate scale for what we actually do in the lab. And, we have warming, with salinity, and then we have various pesticides, which were each individual factors like fungicide, insecticide, antibiotic. We had things like surfactant, which are in all sprayed agricultural products and therefore also found in soils. Yeah, so we used nitrogen deposition. It's just N addition, for example, a whole range of different factors, salinity. And we are exploring others all the time. So this is, as I said, a hobby to figure out what other things might be out there and how could we study them. And potentially, how could we integrate them in this approach of multiple factors? The point is really that they're all different. You know, some are energy, some are resources, some are chemical toxicants, some are organic toxicants like pesticides, some are inorganic like copper or heavy metals. So there's it's quite a diversity of things, basically, that we that we add in this experiment, which of course makes these experiments rather unattractive to set up, to put it mildly, especially if every replicate is different because it's a random draw from this pool of factors that doesn't make things easier. But it's also really hard to work with many different things at the same time, obviously.
But yeah. Matthias, one thing that I found, and it's still I have to wrap my head around it, is that I found really interesting is that independently of that random combination, what you've shown is that just the number of factors that affect a specific soil can be a predictor for the effect that you will get in this soil. So it's irrelevant if you're putting temperature with plastics, with anything else, compaction, whatever it says. So it's just the number of things that you put in this soil that affects this. That I found really fascinating.
Me too. Yeah, I mean, that completely freaked everybody out. When I remember also in lab meeting when we showed the first result, which was on water-stable aggregates, because it's easy and fast to measure. It doesn't cost anything. And so, I mean, there we saw that straight line right away. And then everybody wanted to measure something because it seemed like, wow, this is really fascinating. And of course, we don't have an explanation yet. And this is the continued excitement, basically, about that. We don't really know why that is. You know, it's like just the addition of pressures. But, you know, for example, this water-stable aggregate example, we had three factors of our single factor effects were positive in their effect, and I think four were neutral. So I think 7 out of the 10 factors were neutral or positive in their effect, and only 3 were negative in their effect as single factors. Yet the combination of those was progressively more and more negative. That makes it much harder to understand than if any one of these factors applied by themselves had a negative effect, you know, then you're just saying, you're just doing more negative things. And so, of course, in the end, it's going to be even more negative. And so, but this was very much not the case, because, you know, the vast majority of the factors had neutral and positive effects. And this is also something we're playing around with now. So it just means that, you know, in a certain context, in the situation where you have to deal with many things, even something that could be nominally positive may not be for you at that very moment, you know. And of course, it's quite different if something like soil aggregation is positive effect, that is quite different from an individual bacterium or fungus being affected, right? But we do know that fungal diversity also decreased along a straight line. We're currently still exploring these data from that same experiment with metagenomics and, you know, trying to learn something what might have gone on there. But it is not so easy with this experimental design to figure this out, because this is experimental design answers a specific question. I think it answers it quite well. But of course, then it doesn't allow you to go much deeper into figuring out what exactly made that happen. This is difficult, and I think this is where this needs to go. But for that, we need another idea, I think. Yeah.
This sounds all like we should all worry about that, because it's a lot of stressors. That's what is out there, right? We have multiple stressors at the same time out there. So what can we all do, like also in our home? What can we do to act against that?
Yeah, that is a very difficult question to answer, right? Because you as a person in your behavior is going to be rather insignificant. You know, what does change something is when large numbers of people do something. So, I mean, you can change something and lead by example, or you can vote for certain people that would be affecting certain policies. This is outside of my realm. But, you know, I mean, I do realize that this is not exactly a message of hope. that we are sharing with these results. But I think it's important to do that nevertheless, because I think we need to know this. Now, we need to know if this is actually a problem, or if these things just cancel each other out, you know, that this could have also been happening. And maybe at some to some extent it does happen. We need to know it. Yeah.
So you mentioned this, the difficulty of doing this as individuals, yeah. But, and you mentioned that we should do it all together. So I was just thinking, the way to do something all together is to create legislation that can either factorize all of this knowledge about multiple factors, or that creates a normative on how to monitor them, measure them, whatsoever. So have you thought about how to approach this from a legislation point of view? So from this overall, everyone has to apply this everywhere perspective.
Yeah, no, I'd like to work with some people that know something about policy. Yeah, anybody, Carlos?
Yes, we can do that. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is absolutely right. I think that there is a couple of entrance points to policy, and you know, I think one of the more obvious ones is testing of substances for approval. Mm-hmm. For use in the environment, right? I mean, we are currently approving chemicals for use in the environment based on a study of that chemical by itself. And that to me seems like an obvious weak point.
Yeah.
Because we know from so many experiments now, even also from pairwise interaction experiments, but let alone from these multiple factor experiments, multiple meaning more than four, by the way, in our lab, that, you know, this cannot be done. This is not a fair test of the potential environmental impact mm-hmm. of these substances. Yet this is the legislation, this is the policy, this is the common practice. And I think this is part of why we are at the situation we are at, you know. But that changing that, of course, we cannot expect that people do these experiments, right, in a regulatory framework. It would be completely unreasonable. But I think that there's sort of abbreviated versions of that could be done. We've, you know, played around with that. and that makes it maybe puts it in the hands of more people, where this could sort of more broadly applied in also a regulatory context. But I think that that is very, very interesting to think about. Also, you know, I would add that, yeah, I mean, this does sound like awful, and basically the message is like, you think it's bad? No, it's even worse. it's all not so great because people have a limited pool of worry. They can only worry about so much at a time, which is why I think it is very important to really convey the message of global change as a complex phenomenon that we are collectively causing. Global change is the good umbrella term to use for all of this without having to invoke all of these factors individually in their, you know, dizzying diversity. And however, one thing that I learned this year from a science journalist is that the word global change is simply not known out there in the street. So if you ask somebody in a supermarket, do you know about climate change? They will say, yes, I've heard of that.
Exactly.
If you ask them, have you heard of global change? They will probably say, like, I don't know what that is. So I think that is a sort of something that a gap we should close somehow. Not sure how, but I think, you know, just by writing about it, this is something that I try to do. But I think that the popularizing that term global change in terms of global environmental change caused by humans, that I think is a necessity. I mean, the other point about this being not exactly a ray of hope is that, you know, maybe when all of these things, irrespective of what they are, put us on this trajectory of change in terms of the number of factors, maybe that also means that everything helps, like eliminating everything through policy action and regulatory measures, you know, will reduce the dimensionality of the problem. And, you know, irrespective of the individual effect size of having reduced this one factor, that may already also have a positive effect when you view them all together. I don't know that. One would need to do experiments for that, you know, because there's these effects where the path back is not the same as the path taken there. Hysteresis effects, but I think that is at least also a positive outcome from all of this. And, you know, I'm struggling, and I'm very interested in finding other positive messages, because I am actually a fairly positive person.
I know you are, Matthias.
I'd like to be more positive about these results, you know, but it is sometimes hard. Yeah.
So there's one question left, which we can, you know, try to put more positive. So if you talk to young researchers, I know you do it quite a lot in all these other platforms, like on YouTube and TikTok and so on. But what could you recommend to that topic here today?
Well, I would recommend to watch my YouTube channel. But joking aside, you know, I think that the positive message is that there is so much we don't know. Right? I mean, it seems like we dug just a little bit deeper in one spot of global change biology. There's very many other spots. You know, we have had another project on a rate of change, you know, sudden versus abrupt change versus more gradual change, which is how global change normally occurs. There is so many things to still be discovered. There's also so many potential factors we haven't even thought about yet. We're talking about this all the time in the lab, you know, what have we missed? So I think that is a very positive message for young researchers in terms of, man, there is still a lot to be discovered, because something that has been recently popularized is that, you know, the rate of innovation is decreasing for various reasons, probably funding structure, and maybe because some people say big discoveries have been made. I don't know. I think that, you know, maybe there is some truth to that, but I think that there is also, on the positive side, still so much that can be discovered that is quite fascinating in that particular subfield of global change biology alone. And even when you think about these multiple factors, I think we've just scratched the surface on this. We've just started with that. And I think that there is so much to discover for brilliant new minds. I think that's my positive message.
That's definitely true. And I think that's pretty much the reason why we are all here and keep going and doing research.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Matthias. This was great.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks very much.
So, Romy, what have we learned today?
We learned that it can be hard at the beginning to reach these new and fascinating topics, like not getting any citations, not finding people to get involved. And we learned that multi-stressors are all around, because I think throughout the whole discussion, Matthias was always mentioning that there are multiple stressors, that, for example, you have these tires, and then it's not only the plastic, it's not only the particle, it's the chemicals, and there's all these sorts of facets that come together.
Yeah, that's true. For me, what I really, so there were some aspects of this that I was already, I already knew them, but there was one that Matthias' explanation was quite eye-opening to me. That is the fact that plastics not only are a pollutant, but are also a particle with specific properties that are foreign to soils. And they have an internal volume that also behaves in a completely different way than if it is a soil aggregate. And thinking about the structural implications of that for soils, and plastics are ubiquitous everywhere in land. I don't think that because of the points that Matthias rose about the fact that some plastics are just floating in the air and just fall with rain and things like this, I would imagine that we would be able to find plastics literally everywhere, you know. So this means that we are changing all ecosystems at once without even noticing it. You know?
I was thinking about the same, because it's not the only global change factor where we have this impact. It's also with nitrogen deposition or something, which also happens on a global scale and not only locally. And I was I had the same feeling, like, okay, I didn't know that this also happens to plastic. It's, I mean, in an ocean, you can imagine that it distributes everywhere, but I did never thought about that for the real plastic particles, like the fibers that Matthias mentioned, that they could be everywhere. And I mean, fibers are everywhere. We are also wearing them everywhere. So it's a really big issue, I guess.
Yeah. And if we think, again, from this plastics perspective, just looking around your household, imagine trying to live completely without plastic right now. So just throw away everything that has a plastic component or paint or whatever it is, and you will probably realize that you will be without anything in your living room. You know, you are just throwing out everything, because at some point degree, in some shape or form, you will have plastic materials embedded in almost everything in your daily life.
Yes, and if it's only to cover something, right? Because plastic is water resistant, so pretty well for covering something, especially technique.
And the other aspect for me was that was also quite interesting, was the fact that irrespectively of the factors or pressures that you consider, including plastics, including many other things, you always have this negative effect. And what I would like to highlight there is that Matthias even went to the trouble of explaining to us that 7 out of the 10 factors that he used in his experiment were either individually had a neutral effect or a positive effect. So even when you combine positive effects, you get a negative effect. That's because that's the result of his experiment. Every time that you combine factors, you always get a negative response. So for me, that was also quite important to get out in terms of information, because even when you're testing things and saying, well, this management practice can have a positive effect on your soil, it might not be the case, because when combined with others may result in a negative effect just by the mechanics of it.
Yeah, I mean, I always have to think about that other picture when I hear about these, that multiple things are not beneficial or they can altogether decrease something. Because I then usually think of the human system or something, like when you So there is a certain system, and if you add too much to it, and every stress that you add will just make the system collapse. So even mm-hmm. faster, the more you add. And I like that picture because it usually works pretty well in plant communities, for example, but also the human body, and now also with stressors and soil. Because the more pressure you put on something, even if it's good pressure, it stresses the system because it has to react to it. And if there's too much that it should react to, then it doesn't know what to do and it fails.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But also at the same time, although Matthias was saying that is not necessarily the best positive message, but at the same time, his message of saying that this also the realization that this also means that if you remove one factor independently of what it is, you would have a positive effect on the system.
That's true.
Because you are reducing that stressor. That is a very powerful message that he was probably underplaying it a bit, but for me, it was really powerful because it means that, again, so in the doom scenario, everything is going to hell. Yeah. But in this other scenario where you can have an effect by just removing one of these factors out, this is a really powerful scenario for managers, because managers may not be in control of climate change, but they are in control of other aspects of their land. So they can have a positive effect in their land by just removing these pressure factors out of it.
I like that point of view, that you can do something even with little effort. Just by reducing one of them, you can increase everything. That's nice.
Yeah, well, it's he said that he was not sure, but let's take the positive view on this.
Yes, there's hope. Let's say there's hope.
Yeah, homie, there's hope. There's always hope. So we see each other next month for more hope.
See you next month.